Well, after this fine lady had said, "You mean we get all of this for $5.5 million?" I felt elated. There isn't any doubt of that. Afterwards, after the meeting was over, boy, I went right down to see her, and I met her in the aisle, and I said, "You know, you will never know how close I came to walking right down this aisle and giving you a great big kiss." And that was the nicest thing a person could have said. Well, anyhow, from that point on, we went on, and of course, we had quite a hassle to replace all the schools in Bay City to fireproof structures. And the question was, which schools would we replace? Well, we had made up our mind, as far as the school board had, that no one was going to influence us in any way how these would be replaced. We would just set a 5-year plan, which we did. And then each year, as 1 year was up, we'd set another plan. But no one was to be in on which schools would be replaced. It would be the schools that needed it the worst, and according to what our superintendent and we thought would play into what school would be rebuilt. Well, we stuck to that all through the whole thing. And I think they stuck through that whole thing. Because I remember one group coming in and putting us on the spot and saying, our school is bad. And I still remember saying to these people, if your school is the worst school in the system, you will be the next school to be replaced. And finally even saying to them, even if we were going to rebuild your school, we are not going to tell you about it, but we'll finally make a decision on which school is going to be replaced. And the funny part of it was, that was the old Fremont school out there, when that was rebuilt. But I said, they were the next people, but they kept saying, we want to be next. We said, you will be when we'll make up our mind. But we already had made up our minds. One other interesting thing, I think, on the school board thing was when they named McGregor School out there, and then also the Trombley School. Both of those were built at about at the same year. And we saved a little money on that. But we had to borrow a few thousand dollars in order. The money wasn't coming in quite fast enough, but we had to borrow a few thousand dollars to put the two together and have only one architect's fee. But we saved about, $10,000-$12,000 doing it, as I remember. And of course, right along at this same time, then there came became a high school. They went on from the 9th grade to the 10th grade to the 11th grade and the 12th grade. And then they were accepted down at the University of Michigan. And I remember we went down there and met with the board of the university, and they became an accredited high school, and Art Cansfield was the superintendent, or the principal of that high school at that time. So they became a high school, so we had two high schools. Then the rest of the building programs went on, and each one was replaced, and Charlie Park was superintendent of the schools when this was thought of, and he was an excellent superintendent, and he is the one with this rebuilding that the board had thought that the school system, the schools were in such a bad shape as far as fire prevention is concerned. And with his thinking on replacing these schools to more modern schools, he really was the person that did an awful lot and did really the foster thinking of getting these schools into the modern conception of pay as you go. So we had 5 years of Charlie Park. He was an excellent superintendent, and he was an excellent man in promoting and building the schools also. And then he left and went to Mount Pleasant, and we sure missed him. Now, after that particular time, we had another superintendent, and he went on with the same plan that we had had before of building the schools and carried them on. And he did a very fine job in doing it and following the procedure as it was laid down by the board before. And, of course, that was Paul Briggs. He later here and went to Cleveland. But with the entire educational system, finally, Hampton Township wanted to come in and join the Bay City system. Now, that's the first time anything in Bay City, as I recall, said, let's come from the county and go to the city. So anyhow, we met with Hampton Fractional 2, and we talked with them several times, and they had to go down to Lansing and get special legislation even in order to do this, join the Bay City school system, which they did. They went on, so the next thing, Hampton Fractional 2, when they had to build a building themselves in order to come in and be comparable to the Bay City school system. So they could give to the Bay City school system as much as the Bay City school system already had, as far as building structure and education and other things were concerned.
Well, what were the laws concerning school districts at that time?
Well, the laws concerning school districts were this. They could join the other school district, but they could only be in debt so many mills. And in order to join the Bay City system and to build a new building so they would be comparable to the Bay City school system, they had to go down to Lansing and change and raise that millage in order to join this and legally join our system, which they did. And so we had no troubles at all. We went on. Well, of course, from that point on, you can see what's happened. There's all over, many of the places have joined the Bay City school system. And a lot of schools outside of Bay City are in there now, and you follow them. I don't know all the names because I've been off school board too darn long.
Well, Western High is being built now.
Yeah, that's another. And we knew this. At this time, we talked in terms of a third high school out there, mm-hmm. and which we knew sometime that it would have to come. And it's fine. It's a good school pattern. It's a good school system.
Now, what year are we in now?
Well, I would say this. My years kind of go by hither and yon, but I would say this. That probably would be in when we did this changing of Hampton Fractional 2, I would say that took place probably about in 1956 or 57. There were a lot of things I'm building. There are places here that we thought in Bay City where we might need another school, and then we found that we didn't have to. Now, like, we tore Park School down over on the west side. And that was a long, long time ago. We also found this out. We wanted to build a school out over by down Dean Street and down in there. We thought maybe we could build a four-year school there. But all under there, that was undermined, honeycombed with mine shafts. And that you couldn't build because the thing would settle too darn much. So we thought, no, we can't do that. We can't build right in that vicinity. I don't know, the school board system's gotten along very well since then. They've had troubles and tribulations and one thing and another, but they'll get along. They'll do fine. They'll have other problems as great as ours or greater. Somebody maybe will settle them. Maybe some people want. I know that every time that they vote down here to give some more money to schools, my wife and I would never miss such an election. And we're there and we vote yes, give it to them. Now, will that pick those girls up?
Probably. Dutch, can you tell us some more about your experiences and your life in the lumbering days, what you can remember about that?
Well, I suppose there's several things that a person can bring up, and after a year gone, I'll probably wish I'd thought of this or that. But there is one thing that historically comes back to me, and I thought about quite a few times, that I think is a very, really to me it was quite enlightening. For instance, the first automobile I ever heard, we were in the woods by the cook shanty where we lived at the time, the family, my mother and the kids, one thing and another, and we heard this chook, 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 and we wondered what in the heck that was. And pretty soon, here came an automobile, one of the first. Now this would be probably in just about 1907, along in there. And as it turned out, it was a two-lung brush, in other words, a two-cylinder brush. And the man who was driving it was the boss of the man that owned this lumber company for whom my father was running the can. And his name was Reelman. And he drove in there, and of course it really kind of scared the daylights out of us because we didn't know what the heck it was. But he came up, and gee, we were glad to see him. And he took all of us for a ride in this two-lung brush. That was the first automobile ride that I had ever had. But I have
how did this car get along on the road there?
Well, very good. They were just plain ordinary dusty roads, mm-hmm. and they had ordinary hard tires. And it probably, I don't suppose it did more at the most than 8-10 miles an hour, maybe that much, unless it hit a mud puddle or something, then maybe it stopped. But it was just a plain two-lung brush and two cylinders. And I even often can hear that. I tell you, there's one thing that sounds a little bit like it, and that's when you're up north in there and I hear a pat drumming. This way, it sounds almost like that two-lung brush thing did. Well then, but later, I was very much interested in this brush car because in Cadillac, there was a Presbyterian minister, and he had two daughters. And one of these daughters married an engineer. He was from Detroit. This man had designed a car, and it was in production. And his name was Brush. And he married this Presbyterian minister's daughter. Now, he used to come up there at Cadillac for vacations a lot of time, and of course, Cadillac is a real fine resort town, and Lake Cadillac, Lake Mitchell, and many trout streams, and one thing and another around there. But he later designed another motor. And he said to his wife, "What name should I give to this motor?" And they thought about it and talked about it a lot. And finally, she said, "Why, you've always loved Cadillac. Why don't you call it Cadillac?" And that's what he did. And so the man who designed the Brush car, her name was Brush, named it after him, designed Cadillac motor, and the Cadillac motor is not named after the Explorer, it's named after Cadillac, Michigan. Now, I don't know, I've never bought one of the men's cars yet, because I've never had quite that much money. But nevertheless, I'm glad to know that he took the name of Cadillac in there. And also, along with this, I still remember reading about when Cadillac burned down. It was all lumbering town and all pine lumber and everything, and it just plain burned down, and they rebuilt it. And then the center, Manton, used to be the capital or the county seat. And then one time, Cadillac came and stole all the records of Manton. Took him to Cadillac, and always after that, Cadillac was the county seat for Wexford County. That's another thing I just happened to remember. You know, there's one other thing I suppose that I ought to remember, and maybe I ought to bring it in. You talk about your first radio and one thing and another. When we lived in this lumber camp, we had a telephone, and which they did. There were a few telephones, but they would go from one person to another, and they were all in the same line, like you'd ring and everybody's line would dingle, and you'd have like two longs and three shorts or something like that. You'd have a ring. Of course, everybody would pick it up, and everybody would say, "My goodness, is that so? It's too bad." See? But anyhow, my father used to do a lot of singing, and he had us doing a lot of singing. You talk about your first radios. My father would give a chord on the piano, like, "Do, sol, mi, do." And then he'd say, "All right, we'll sing now, The Master Wants Workers," or some hymn or something like that. And so we'd all go in, and I was too young to sing then, but the older ones, they did very well at it because they were good singers. But often the people would call up on this line and say, "Why don't you stand in front of the phone and sing for us and play the organ?" Well, my father could chord the organ, and so could a couple of my sisters in, and they'd chord. But then we'd sit there, or they would sit there and sing hymns for them. So I often think of all of this TV, all the entertainment, all of everything. I think probably that's one of the first things like would be likened to maybe a radio that is could be. But they and things would be very glad to do that. Now, those are a lot of things in the lumbering days, and a lot of things in Cadillac. I remember another guy in Cadillac too that quit school. We talk now about keeping to school until they're in the 16. Well, some of those guys, I suppose, at 16 maybe don't want to be in school. Well, this was a guy that started in second grade with me, Cadillac. His name was George Mopsatson. His uncle had a Mopsatson soda place there. He was a Greek boy. And he had this soda place, and anyhow, George stopped. I think George stopped, I don't know, third, fourth, maybe fifth grade, something like that. He quit. And he went and worked in the restaurant, in the soda fountain. But I didn't. I kept right on the going. Boy, I graduated from high school, and I got a degree, and I taught at college. And while I was there, another fellow came, and he bought out Spears Restaurant. It was George Mopsatson, who'd only gone to school to the fourth or fifth grade. Well, I used to go down to George and say, "Hi, George, we talk about old times," and say, "Could you give a few of the college boys a job here?" "Sure, Dutch, I'll give them a job." And he'd always give them a job. One day we were talking, he'd invested in oil and one thing another around Mount Pleasant. And I said, "You know, George, there's quite a bit of difference between you and me. You learned in your youth how to really slop soda from good." Boy, I went on to school. Now I said, "You're a millionaire and I'm just barely paying for my living." We've often laughed about that. We have, because that's one way of American life, I guess. People can go, and if you have a good idea, it's really something.
What was transportation like in Cadillac when you were going to school?
Well, I remember when we bought our first Ford. It was a 1912. And there's a hill outside of Cadillac that's on the road to Jennings, this town I mentioned somewhat earlier. And that's quite a big hill. And before we bought that, my brother, who was 4 years older than I, and myself, took this car out, and boy, that was some car. It went up Wilson Hill on high. And that was really some car. Now you don't even know you're going up a hill there when you go. But that's about the way transportation was then. You'd take, for instance, gosh, I knew about Fords in those days. It had the brass band around the top and around the radiator. And if one of the pistons got knocking, you'd hurry up, run it in the garage or someplace, in the barn usually, you didn't have a garage, take the bottom grease pan off, take the oil out, and you'd reach up there with a wrench and unfasten the bearings, one of the bearings, take them out, and if it's bad enough, you might even run Babbitt in there. And then you'd put it back in and put shims under the darn thing, and you'd tighten it up and put the oil back in, and you could hardly crank it this way, but it would finally, you'd get it started, it'd go, then it'd wear enough, and then you'd stop it, take the crankcase off, put another couple shims in. Finally, you'd get it all so it was running along, everything was fine. That's about the way it was. You'd sit there and you'd adjust the coils. You'd say, oh, number four isn't hitting very good, and you'd go like this and turn it. Well, it isn't that, it must be the spark plug. It was as simple as that.
Can you tell me some more about what happened to the railroad around the lumber camp?
Yeah, I think so. Now, like, when they wanted, when these railroad companies, not the railroad companies, the lumber camps established a narrow gauge railroad. That would be so they would go out where the big railroads weren't. And they just, this narrow gauge would, it was much smaller than the regular one. They'd go right on out and go into the woods and where they could load these logs up where rivers weren't. Their first preference was hauling by river if possible. But later on, they're just, well, they were lumber and timber where rivers were not. So that they'd have these narrow gauge tracks. So they'd run and put these logs on these trains and then little motors, which you see a lot of them, regular little trains would haul them in there to be logged. But now take the Ann Arbor Railroad, for instance, which ran through Cadillac. That railroad was, there are several things I remember about that. One was, there were the passenger lines and many passenger trains went over this. Well, then later they put what they called the motor on this thing. In this motor was a much smaller, just a one compartment job, and I guess it had a smoker maybe in it. It did, of course, had a ladies' restroom and a men's restroom in it. But you would pick this up, and you could pick this motor up any place, at a crossing, and it ran on in gasoline. Didn't run in coal, nobody shoveled it, it just ran in gasoline. It'd go up and down the track. They had those all the way from Frankfort, I think, to Toledo. Running up and down, they'd take different ways there, and then go back. But why remember that? You could go out here and like here, Sluter's Crossing, just a little way from Cadillac. 5 miles out, you'd go buy your ticket to Slug's Crossing. You'd get out, go there and pick blackberries maybe, or maybe huckleberries. And then you'd come back and, well, there'd be one or two motors coming back, and you'd wait at the crossing till it came back, and you'd go back to Cadillac in the motor. And I remember the students when I was at college, going to school at the college in Mount Pleasant when those motors were running. Why, students always used to wait at the crossing out there, go to Shepherd, go on from Shepherd further on down, maybe to Ashley or Alma or someplace, or over the other way to Clare, to Farwell, places up in there. And usually the guy that ran a lot of those runs would know an awful lot of people because they would ride that a lot. And like a lot of these little spurs, it'd be so, it was all, almost a family affair. Like old Charlie the conductor would get on and somebody would say, hey, I want to stop over to Maud's down here. Well, we'll stop the train down there. And they'd stop the train there and she'd get off over there. So maybe Charlie would get on or somebody else would get on the railroad and he'd say, hey, geez, you had tough going with that calf last week. How'd that come out? Oh, Jesus, we called the doctor, but the calf died. Or else maybe, no, the calf is fine. It's good. It's coming fine. In all family history, everything, the conductor knew everything that was going on, and people would stop him and get on the railroad, and he'd know right where they'd want to get off. And
how much did it cost to ride this motor?
Oh, gosh, I think it was, I know it wasn't very much. I know at one time, I'm just speaking from memory now, it seemed to me it might be 2 cents a mile or something like that. But I think they're now like, they maybe had like Sluter's Crossing, for instance, from Cadillac to Sluter's Crossing, we'd say was maybe 5 miles. Where? They might have charged nickel or dime for that, I don't know. There was Lucas just a little way out of Cadillac, probably 6 miles. Now, maybe they charged 10 cents for that. I don't know. But all those places where it's just about the same. And here's one other thing I think that was quite interesting. It cost you so little to go from one town to the other that I know I tried to be an enterprising dealer one time, and so I went from Cadillac to Manton and paid my railroad fare, and I went there, and you could buy butter cheaper in Manton than you could in Cadillac. So, in good butter. So I went to Manton, and I bought like maybe $7, $8, $10 worth of butter in Manton. Now, we ever got that much money, because boy, a dollar was a lot in those days. But anyhow, I bought some butter and I took it back to Cadillac and sold it, and I think I made $1.25. That's more than they used to make in the table factory in Cadillac, and it's more than they used to make in the chair factory or the sawmills in a day in Cadillac. So I did that a few times, and then one time a guy in Manton gypped me. And I always said, if I can let a guy chip me and I can't make a cent, to hell with it. So. Now, you know, we've been talking about this railroad transportation all the time and going from one town to the other and so forth. But you know, in Michigan, there are a lot of other transportations that you sure have to consider and that have played an awful important part to Michigan history. There, of course, are the Great Lakes. Of course, that transportation nobody argues about because there's millions and millions of tons go over every year. But more important to Bay City is the Saginaw River. Now, that has quite a history in itself. And I play a little part in this particular thing. In the Saginaw River, they found out this. To get the big boats on up, they had to dredge the river. And any time you let a river go long enough silt gathers in it so that it fills in, and it has to be dredged. So they formed a committee to dredge the river so larger boats could go in and go further up. But this committee didn't seem to agree. And so finally, another committee was called, a committee to vitalize the other committee. But I was either fortunate or unfortunate enough to be the chairman of that thing. So we called everybody together, and everybody seemed to want to do things. Industry played an important part, and they were willing to contribute. The boats were willing to contribute. The people that had hit the hardest would be the railroad people, because the Army engineers that had made the survey to do this thing found out that it would cost them money to shore up their railroad bridges and things like that if they were going to go deeper. So anyhow, they ran into a snag. And so we waited a while. They didn't seem to want to do anything. So we called another meeting, and we really gave them thunder. And this time, everybody got together. The river was dredged. The boats go up. We have boats coming in there now, and they go clear on up into Saginaw. They go all the way along the river, and they carry a tremendous tonnage, and we are most happy for it. But that's what your rivers can do in the state of Michigan, as far as historical or anything else. Here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lovelock.
I don't think that he knows what he wants.